Support for Impact Cincinnati comes from Murray and Robin Sinclair.
Good morning. This is Impact Cincinnati and 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Heroin overdoses in Hamilton County have gone up 700% in the past 6 years. Overdoses are the number one non-natural cause of death in the county. And Northern Kentucky accounts for 63% of all heroin possession and trafficking in the state. This morning, we're going to talk about this growing problem. Joining me are Northern Kentucky Drug Strike Force Director Bill Mark, Christ Hospital Family Practice Physician Dr. Mike Kalfas. Dr. Kalfas is also the former medical director at St. Elizabeth Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, and Cincinnati Police Department Drug Task Force Supervisor Sergeant Chris Connors. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can email your questions and comments to impact@wvxu.org or post them on our Facebook page. Good morning.
Good morning.
Certainly happy to have everyone here. I want to start out by saying that we always post our topic on Facebook on Monday morning and just give people a chance to add some comments and questions if they'd like. And within seconds of posting it, I had a number of comments and more probably in that and private messages from so many folks I can't count about this topic. So clearly it has hit home with a lot of people, and I'm going to try very hard to get to everybody's questions and comments, but there are a lot of them today. The way I'd like to start is really just have you all describe the problem. How serious a problem is heroin use in Greater Cincinnati?
In Northern Kentucky, it seems like it's been a gradual progression from, you know, years, maybe 5 years ago, where there was, you know, a moderate amount of heroin on the streets, but primarily what we're seeing a lot of was prescription drug abuse, oxycodone abuse. And over the last 5 years, it's gone from, you know, that mix to where it's primarily heroin on the street, very little prescription drugs. Really, that's all the trafficking investigations that our agency is doing is primarily heroin.
Is that because the other drugs are just harder to get now?
Maybe they're harder to get, but, you know, it's a consumer-driven trade. And, you know, the people that we arrest and that we interview say, you know, they're selling heroin because that's what the people want.
I think availability has a lot to do with it too, though, because I had worked in a drug task force on the West Coast, and tar heroin and powder heroin were always available out there, and we had our problems. When I came back to Cincinnati in 1990, it was there, but it just wasn't so prevalent as cocaine, and then of course crack. But then right around the millennium, we started really seeing it, and now it's prevalent. And what's interesting, and I think Bill could probably back me up on this, is that those cocaine dealers that we worked in the late 90s and early 2000s are now selling heroin because I guess the market is there, and of course the availability is there.
On the treatment side of things, I can sort of speak to that as well. I started doing addiction medicine back in 1997. And in the unit that I worked in, I probably saw maybe one or two heroin addicts come in a month. And that it was unusual. We always kind of thought of Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky as a pill town. What happened in the late 90s is there was a very steady transition. And I think it amounted, or it came about from a lot of different sources. But one very obvious source to me was the fact that we had people addicted to larger and larger amounts of prescription opiates, such as the drug OxyContin. When supply became an issue, cost became an issue. I mean, on the street, that stuff usually went for about a dollar a milligram. So an 80-milligram OxyContin was very expensive. Patients would develop extremely high tolerances for it, and they just simply couldn't afford to keep taking it. So the only thing that provided the potency to meet the addiction was heroin, and I think the heroin dealers really moved in to a ready-made market that grew out of the pill addiction scene that was already present in the 90s. So they kind of moved into a ready-made market and met a need, so to speak, that was there. And just like you all said already, there was a consumer-driven escalation of heroin in this area, and it's just gone exponential.
Yeah, and the cost comparison, I think, is very important. You know, like you said, you know, somebody might have an oxycodone habit that was costing them upwards of $200 a day. and they could satisfy that for maybe, you know, $50 to $100 a day worth of heroin.
Wow. Josh wants to know where the heroin's being trafficked from, and isn't it sold mainly in the city or in the suburbs as well?
Everywhere.
Well, I think I can answer that. Is when the crack epidemic came through, you know, throughout the 90s and into the millennium, it seemed like it was an inner city market, sometimes open air market, sometimes, you know, behind closed doors. But we're seeing a little bit different here. Not to say that those markets aren't there, but I think a lot of our addicts are coming from the suburbs and the rural areas. It's the addicts or the people dependent on these opiates are not confined to the social, economically deprived areas of the inner city like crack kind of was.
Well, Michael questioned, and this is, I think you're getting to the answer. He says, is this a situation where people will drive into other over the Rhine or other crime areas or neighborhoods you wouldn't necessarily be living in to get the heroin, or is it moving to where the demand is? And you're saying it is moving.
Well, I'm saying both. It has mimicked the crack market as well. Like, for instance, the open-air markets or the drive-up window service. That is there. That is prevalent. However, we're starting to see a kind of a new trend in heroin, especially when it comes to tar. It's a delivery service. Mm-hmm. And if I can... A three-part series by L.A. Times writer Sam Quiñones attacked this issue. Reference it's a Mexican drug organization, but it's a delivery service. So now these addicts don't have to go into these risky neighborhoods, getting robbed or shot, and so on and so forth.
The dealers bring the drugs to them.
The dealers bring the drug to them. They order it by telephone and it's delivered. And we're seeing a lot of this. And not to say that the other open-air markets aren't there still. They are. But a lot of these delivery people, so to speak, they live in various areas outside in the suburbs, and they deliver to, like, I know in Cincinnati, they make a lot of deliveries to the Price Hill area. They will come downtown. But I'm sure they're all over in Kentucky. I know they're in the northern suburbs of Cincinnati.
I know when I first started asking patients, you know, about how they were obtaining this stuff and how they got into it, it almost always was marked by a trip downtown. I think Northern Kentucky police used to notice that, you know, unusual behaving cars crossing the river were, you know, a great reason to check things out. But now that trend is really reversed, I think. You're exactly right. They're getting it. The small town that's 40 miles south of downtown that I used to practice in, heroin was not very big there as recently as 5 years ago. I mean, it was there, but people had to drive to get it. And economically, they, you know, with gas at $4 a gallon, they couldn't get there to get it. Now it's the small town America. It's right there on the street. I mean, they're having a huge problem with it. So the delivery system is definitely adapting and mutating to counter what law enforcement's done.
And it's not so much I'm not leaving to come make this delivery unless it's a certain quantity. I don't believe there's any quantity too small, right, that these people, that this organization won't deliver. So
it's like pizza.
It is like pizza delivery.
Yeah. This is from Ray. Are local law enforcement departments coordinating their efforts at all? Is there any assistance being provided by the federal agencies?
Absolutely. I mean, Chris and I, you know, knew each other and have worked together, you know, long before we walked in the studio today. And I think, you know, that's just indicative that you have law enforcement, you know, from Cincinnati and from Northern Kentucky, you know, working together, you know, because, you know, that river, you know, is, you know, can't, it isn't a barrier to the drug dealers, so we can't allow the river to be a barrier to law enforcement either.
Aliyah wants to know, is the heroin problem worse than the prescription drug problem, and what's the cure rate with heroin long-term when you're taking treatment?
My personal opinion from what I've seen in practice is that, as I follow up to what I said initially, I think the heroin problem is a direct offspring of the prescription drug problem. And likewise, people that get addicted to large amounts of prescription drugs, even at this point, still end up gravitating toward heroin from a cost issue. A lot of people are afraid of needles to start with, but the potency of the drugs available right now are so strong that people can initially snort it, so they're no longer afraid of needles. That's not keeping people away. So I think the two go hand in hand. It fluctuates. In my practice, I'll see runs of everybody being addicted to heroin and very few pill users, and then it'll switch the other way for a little bit. It's really bobbing back and forth, but I think the heroin problem, once it gets a root in an area, just tends to take off and grow like an infestation. And as far as cure rates are going to depend on the treatment modality. You have to look back to the initial studies done, half a century or better ago by Dr. Rice and his crew that brought out the concept of methadone maintenance. Their initial findings were that heroin dependency is a organic brain disease that is not curable. Much like our mentality of treating an HIV patient today is, we'll get you on medication, and as long as you stay on this medication, you'll function, you'll be okay, your life will be fairly normal. But there's always this, hanging back. If you stop your medication, you'll die. That's the same kind of mentality that was introduced initially with methadone maintenance. We know now that many patients can be successfully weaned off methadone, and a good, solid methadone program can save a lot of lives. But again, there's so many variables and so many qualifications on what constitutes a good, effective methadone treatment program. And there are several places in the country that have really shining examples of what that is. You can probably get well over 50-60% results in those scenarios. The drug Suboxone, when used in an appropriate patient, used appropriately, associated with counseling, can get 50-60% success rates as well. If you look at an abstinence-based detox where you put a patient in a drug and alcohol unit, give them a medically mediated detox, which means you simply treat their flu-like symptoms for up to a week, detoxify them, send them to an outpatient counseling meeting, an intensive outpatient, et cetera, the success rate at 6 months is about less than 5%. Wow. Because the chemical instability in their brain precludes their normal functioning and just the.
So this is not a cold turkey kind of.
No, this it and that's the we've tried that and it just doesn't work.
I want to say I got a couple of comments. I'll just read them briefly related to this. This is from Rebecca. She says, as an emergency worker, I see it on a daily basis, and she says recovery from addiction, as far as she's seen, is very limited. We've also heard from Eric, who says, in 2004, as a senior in high school, I put myself through rehab to combat drug addiction involving LSD and heroin. I haven't used either one in over 8 years. I'm familiar with addiction and the lifestyle required to continue using drugs. An ounce of treatment is worth a pound of punishment.
And maybe Dr. Halpin can answer this better, but I some of the scare tactics in the 50s and so forth of you use this one time and you're going to be addicted. And that may be true of some people, but I don't think that is true of everyone. The same goes with all these other drugs. And I think there's a lot of studies going on right now about addictive personalities and whether it's gene-based or personality-based or whatever.
Well, so certainly. And the propensity to be addicted to an opiate, especially, is just like alcohol. There's a huge genetic contribution. And we know, for instance, that 20% of the population carries a mutation in their mu receptor. Mu is a type of opioid receptor in the brain. That's the one that's hit most markedly by heroin and similar drugs. That 20%, when that drug comes in contact with that mutated receptor, it sets them off in a way unprecedented to the other 80% of the population, and their brain just reacts with sort of the sensation of, where have you been all my life? And it really is a love at first sting sort of thing. And those folks particularly have a hard time.
I want to talk more about this. And again, if you have questions or comments as we talk about heroin this morning, send them to impact@wvxu.org, or better yet, post them on our Facebook page. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment.
Support comes from the Greater Cincinnati Foundation. Support comes from the Greater Cincinnati Foundation. Whether your giving comes from faith, family, or a place in your heart, the Greater Cincinnati Foundation can help you make the most of it during this season of giving and all year long. More information at gcfdn.org or 513-241-2880.
Support comes from Johnson Investment Counsel, founded in 1965 on the principle that clients' futures come first. Because while money matters, people matter more. Information is available online at johnsoninv.com. Johnson Investment Counsel, solid values, sophisticated solutions.
Support comes from Findlay Market. You can shop locally on holiday weekends through December 23rd for your holiday meals and events. Caracol Incorporated offers Christmas trees, wreaths, and roping for purchase on Saturdays and Sundays at the market. You can visit the website for more holiday event information, findlaymarket.org. That's findlaymarket.org.
This is Impact Cincinnati at 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking today about heroin use in the greater Cincinnati area. My guest, Northern Kentucky Drug Strike Force Director Bill Mark, Christ Hospital Family Practice Physician Dr. Mike Kalfas. He's also the former medical director of St. Elizabeth Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, and Cincinnati Police Department Drug Task Force Supervisor Sergeant Chris Connors. Again, if you have a question or a comment, email impact@wvxu.org. or post them on our Facebook page. And Dr. Kalfas, you were talking a lot about different drugs that you can give people to get them off the heroin use. And some other folks in the room here said a lot of people question that, saying, aren't you just substituting one drug for another?
And that's a very good point. And traditionally, in addiction medicine, we always had sort of an abstinence-based approach, where we would help you get through the withdrawals, give you treatment, and keep you clean. The 12-step programs are always based off of this staying abstinent. Just don't do your next one and you'll be fine. And that's the way I was trained, and I agree with that. However, as I said, we have when you look at something where the mainstay of treatment has less than a 5% 6-month success rate, you have to question, why are we still using that treatment? We know that we can get higher success rates and we can save lives. We're dealing with a deadly disease here. We can save lives if we use medication-assisted treatments.
And are those better just because they're legal? Why are those drugs better than heroin?
Well, when you get into exactly what they do in the body, let me digress for just a second. The mu receptor that I mentioned earlier causes intense euphoria when it's stimulated. Heroin and other drugs will stimulate that receptor thousands of times more intensely than natural occurring substances in your brain, like endorphins or enkephalins. What'll happen is, if you think of the mu receptor as being like the lock on a door, and the drug is the key, heroin is the key that goes in the lock, turns the lock, causes something to happen. Methadone is a very powerful lock as well. It's cheap to make. It has a long half-life. But it stimulates that receptor just like heroin and other drugs do. The advantage is it can be administered under medical supervision and be incorporated in as part of a treatment program.
So why are people not ODing on that?
It needs to be monitored. Bringing you up to Suboxone. The way to think of it is Suboxone or buprenorphine. Buprenorphine is a drug that's been around for a long time. We call that an agonist-antagonist drug. And basically, the way to look at that, perhaps, is a key that goes into the lock but then breaks off and doesn't actually stimulate the lock, at least as well. It may turn it a little bit, but it goes in the lock, breaks off, doesn't stimulate it nearly as much, so it's not an intense high. It's almost impossible to overdose on buprenorphine unless you're abusing benzodiazepines with it. And it has a lot of advantages. Unfortunately, the success rate is not quite as high as methadone, but the complication rate is a lot lower. Finally, there's also a new medication that's at the market. There's within the last few years, there's a once-a-month injection of an opioid blocker that you can get once a month, that once you've been detoxed for a week, you can get this shot monthly from a physician or from a nurse, and it limits the craving. It's like, think of it as something that fits over the lock and keeps everything out of it. It allows you to limit the craving of the person. It helps balance the brain chemistry a little sooner, and it removes their ability to get high if they did use, or at least limits it significantly by blocking that mu receptor. So if they do have illicit use, they can't stimulate that mu receptor, and they're more likely to stay focused on their treatment.
Changing course a little bit here, this question from Nicole. She says, why does the heroin issue occur here in Greater Cincinnati, meaning what are the local conditions that contribute to the use?
Well, usually it was confined to the big city, Chicago, LA, New York, maybe Baltimore, Miami, some of these big metropolitan areas. But for some reason, and it has migrated to these Midwest, mid-sized metropolitan areas and suburbia around them. And in fact, they're seeing these same problems in rural West Virginia and rural Kentucky. These areas that the availability of heroin and was null. And now, of course, with the pills and the cravings for these opioids, then they know they have to go to the city. But now, of course, some of these organizations are actually delivering out into the rural areas and the suburbs. But I want to touch on one thing. A lot of people, a lot of the ideas are, and maybe you can clear this up, Doc, is that the these addicts are basically hardworking people that maybe hurt their back or hurt their knee, and they're prescribed oxycodone or OxyContin for a period of time. They become addicted, and the doctors cut them off because they're healed and they're still addicted to drugs, and then they seek out heroin because it's cheaper. Now, I know that has happened, and but I think it's more the exception than the rule. A lot of these heroin addicts that I'm seeing, they were into coke in the 90s, in the 2000s, and now they're partiers. They're going to go after whatever drug that does what they want it to do.
I think the scary part of this epidemic is that both are correct.
Right.
I'm seeing a lot of both of those on the treatment, and I'm seeing the most frightening trend that I'm seeing clinically is the trend of young people that basically equate snorting heroin at a party the way we used to equate smoking marijuana in the 80s. You know, they're very nonchalant about it. They're very, well, here, try this. It's a great buzz. And they're really opening a can of worms that they're ill prepared to deal with. And I see that end. I see the young people that are sucked into it by just being too adventurous and careless. I do see the people that, as a response of medication misadventures, end up in that venue as well. And I'm personally afraid that some recently passed legislation in Northern Kentucky is scaring a lot of doctors away from treating patients with pain conditions. And I'm afraid we're going to see an increase in heroin as a result of that. But I do also see the people that, you know, the all drug Joes out there on the street that try it. But it's pretty ubiquitous. It's hitting everybody.
If in fact the pills are the gateway to heroin addiction, a study came out just, I think, in the last week or two from the University of Colorado saying that abuse of prescription pills by adolescents is up 40%. So if, in fact, it is, prescription pills are the illegal use of prescription pills are the gateway to heroin addiction, then we got some problems coming our way.
I don't know that it's necessarily the gateway to heroin addiction, but I think it was the gateway to heroin's hold in our area. That's how it got in here in the first place. Now that it's here, it's just it's spreading like wildfire. And yes, the adolescents are getting sucked into it primarily without having to stop at the step of a pill addiction. But
I wanted to mention, as I got so many comments from folks all week long about this, many of them were private messages. I think people just not wanting to go public about what they knew. But a lot of folks said that they were surprised that they knew people for a long time, could sit next to them once a week and have lunch and have no idea they were taking heroin. Is that true? Are these functioning members of society for the most part?
I think it runs the gamut. You have people that can be functional users, and you know, just like you said, it really escapes the detection by family and friends. You know, they still have a family life. They can still hold down a job. And then you have the people on the other extreme that, you know, from the minute they wake up in the morning, you know, all they care about is you know, getting that first hit, getting that high. And those are the people that, you know, aren't contributing members of society. You know, they can't hold down a job. And I think that's why we see such an increase in the amount of other crimes of thefts, you know, scrap metal thefts, burglary, shoplifting. You know, where if you talk to these people, they'll tell you, well, you know, I'm doing that to support my heroin habit.
Bill, there's apparently been a recent formation of a group in Northern Kentucky sort of to address all of this. Can you talk about that?
You talking about the Vision 2015?
Is that part of it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. We're trying to take more of a multidisciplinary approach to treatment, education, and just information sharing throughout the community. We have partnerships between community groups, law enforcement, physicians, St. Elizabeth Healthcare, just to kind of attack this problem from all angles, because we can't just make it a law enforcement approach to the problem, because it's not strictly a law enforcement problem.
Susan wants to know, what are the public and private schools doing to address this, and what are parents doing? Are you finding that schools and parents are getting involved? Is it young kids or high school kids that are big offenders?
Absolutely. And a lot of our educational programs are targeted towards high school kids and their parents. So that, we try to inform the high school kids, about, the danger of heroin abuse, and about how, opioid abuse can lead you down that road, and also try to educate their parents about the signs and what to look for.
That's the part that perplexes me, because I know I'm old enough to, in the 70s and late 60s, there was somewhat of a heroin epidemic then, and everybody was informed, or at least maybe knew someone, and they understood how going down this road and would always lead to addiction and ruin your life forever. And then I guess there's a little bit of loss of memory, or a generation has passed. I'm not calling this an epidemic, but many do. This would not be our first heroin epidemic. I mean, in the turn of the century had the same thing. And then, of course, the 60s, 70s. And then now a generation or two later, we have it again.
Well, that's correct. I mean, heroin's been around since about, I believe, the 1880s. It was first synthesized. It's not a difficult compound to make for a chemist. The difference between what we had in the 70s and what we have now is the potency of the drug, as I'm sure you're well aware. It was unusual to be able to snort heroin in the 1970s. You pretty much had to IV inject it to get much out of it.
Are people snorting it now?
Yes, they're starting it. It's so potent that they're starting out snorting. That's the problem. 14-year-old kids at a party can snort this stuff, put a little up their nose, and just like they used to use powder cocaine. And only as the addiction progresses do they have to start injecting, because the amounts needed to go through the nose become too high, too unaffordable, so they move to the needle. But in the 70s, you had to start with a needle, so that just blocked a lot of people out. To begin with, it had needle phobia. Now you don't have to start with a needle. Most that don't quit will end up on, almost all will end up on the needle eventually, but they don't believe that when they start. They think, I hear this all the time. I'm afraid of needles. I would never do that. And then 6 months to a year later, they're shooting the stuff into their arms.
As their tolerance increases, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
Because it would cost you $80, $120, $200 a day, whereas you can get a much lower amount for $40 and inject it and get a better buzz. So.
I should mention, we've had a number of comments and questions also about needle exchange programs and hepatitis C and all of that, which we just don't have time to get into today, because we are out of time now. The show is over, I'm sorry to say. So much more to talk about. I hope we can have you all back, and maybe we'll hear some good news that things are getting better.
All right, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for being here, and thank you for listening to Impact Cincinnati on 91.7 WVXU. My guests today were Northern Kentucky Drug Strike Force Director Bill Mark, Christ Hospital Family Practice Physician Dr. Mike Kalfas, and Cincinnati Police Department Drug Task Force Supervisor Sergeant Chris Connors. Archives of our programs are available on our website at wvxu.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier.
Support comes from the Murray and Agnes Season Good Good Government Foundation, encouraging citizen participation in public affairs.